I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third generation Cure Master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at SurreyFarms.com or VirginiaTraditions.com.
Hi, this is Bernie Wise on the Heritage Radio Network. The program is The Naturalist, and we're broadcasting from Roberta's Restaurant in beautiful downtown Bushwick. It's a sunny day, and today's program is a very interesting one. I have three guests, and we're going to be talking about a special program that the Museum of Natural History has, and it's called the Discovery Room. And first, I'll introduce the folks, and then we'll talk about the Discovery Room. So the first person I want to introduce is Danny, is it Ziegler?
Zeiger.
Danny Zeiger, who is in charge of the Discovery Room. And next, we have Ariana Ricard, who works in the Discovery Room.
Thanks for having me on again.
Okay. Right. Ariana was on before with... Which program did we do, Ariana?
Silkworm.
The Silkworm. So I called her the queen of the silkworms. So, and the other person here today is Barbara Cohn, who volunteers in the Discovery Room. Right, Barbara? Say hi.
Good morning.
Okay. So first, Danny, I want to ask you a question, too, about your background. How did you get into this kind of thing and all that?
I got into science education work, actually, from the zookeeping world after college. Background in biology and environmental studies. I became a zookeeper. Did a lot of work with cows and sheep and pigs and goats, but also, you know, birthday parties and playing with kids and teaching them about how to take care of animals, the diversity of animals, showing them what a snake was, and just kind of getting them excited about science. And when I moved to New York, continued that work through a teaching fellowship up at the Bronx Zoo with Wildlife Conservation Society, which led to an opening at the museum. They wanted someone who could work with animals, who could work with kids, and who had a passion for this kind of learning. And I find myself very lucky to have been able to fit that position and to be at the museum now for coming up on 6 years.
Yeah. As far as I'm concerned, it's a great place to be. I mean, if I was a little kid, I'd be there every day.
Yeah.
It's really terrific. So, Ariana, how about you? Give us a little background.
Well, let's see. My graduate work was in ecology at the University of Michigan, and I studied frogs. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I was in the Peace Corps in Ecuador, and then came back to New York City, and I worked for a year at Old Westbury Gardens in Long Island doing education work there. But I volunteered at the museum for the Center for Biodiversity and Conservation, and then applied for the job in the Discovery Room just about a year ago.
Mm-hmm. Barbara?
Well, I'm an English major in college, and a teacher, and a variety of other positions during my working life. And when I retired, I kept thinking, where in New York do I never have enough time? And I figured it was the museum. So I came and I volunteered as a teaching volunteer for a few years and ended up in the Discovery Room.
Right, terrific. So you mentioned about you were a zookeeper. Mm-hmm. You still are, in a way, a zookeeper, right?
Well, yeah, we do have a fair number of small live animals right in the Discovery Room. I've turned over most of the keeping duties, though, to Ariana since she's come on board in the last year, which has been nice. I do miss working with the animals and steal a few moments with them from time to time.
Yeah.
But it's also nice not to be the one to have to take care of the poop.
Okay. So give us a general overview of the Discovery Room, the philosophy and how it works and all that. And then we'll talk about the individual great things you have.
Sure. The Discovery Room was designed to be a gateway to the rest of the museum. So all the museum sciences are represented on some level. We have an area about biodiversity, collections, paleontology, tools of science, microscopes, seismology, astronomy, science resources, And the idea behind the activities is to give visitors a chance to explore the way science is done, to practice observation skills, to practice asking questions, to get their hands dirty and you know, get involved in the tools of the science that goes on at the museum, so that when they leave the discovery room and go out to the main exhibits at the museum, they'll have a chance to have a greater appreciation of the kind of science that's going on at that institution. They'll look a little bit more closely at the dioramas. They'll have a better appreciation of the structure of the jaw of the T-Rex when they see the T-Rex. Hopefully it'll build a connection to the museum's programs that will be lifelong.
Mm-hmm. So it's a great introduction for kids. Right. So what age groups do you accommodate, Danny?
The design of the room is for 5 to 12, but we really don't discriminate.
Right.
We get a lot of younger children in there, you know, as long as parents are with them and cautious with them and make sure they don't stick, you know, shells into their mouth or anything like that, then we have no problem with it.
Right.
We also get a lot of adults coming through. We do have things for older children and adults. We have lots of curious people who want to learn. They want to touch things and they want to ask questions. And we have facilitators there, people like Barbara and Ariana, who can come in and help you find answers to your questions and are really knowledgeable and excited about that kind of work.
Right. That's great. Jack, do you have the pictures on from the... Okay, great. So, folks, if you want to see some pictures from the Discovery Room, they're on the our site. You know, just go on, and you'll find the pictures there that Ariana took. I think they're are your photos, Ariana?
Oh, no. Two of the photos are from the museum photographer, Roderick Mickens. And then I think one Danny took.
Mm-hmm.
And then I forget the fourth.
Okay,
the fourth was the kid with the magnifying glass looking at the show.
That's Roderick as well. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So.
Okay, great. So they're great pictures of the Discovery Room. So let's talk a little bit about the individual activities. Let's say a kid comes in, and how do you work it out? You just let him go with wherever he wants to, or how does it work out?
That's the idea. I mean, you walk in and you're greeted with lots of interesting things to look at. One of the main centerpieces of the room is a almost life-sized African baobab tree replica, which is filled with animals. And the kids come in and they see a baboon sitting up in the tree, and then we can challenge them to take a survey of the tree. Some kids prefer the word scavenger hunt, but what they're really doing is the same work that our field biologists do when they go out into the field. They're looking at animals, trying to classify which animals are in a specific location, and finding things, and just kind of finding out about how these animals are exploring, living in the world around them, how they use the tree as a home. And then we give them tools, magnifying glasses, flashlights, things like that to help them bring themselves into the role of being a scientist.
Right.
For
and I noticed they walk around with a clipboard.
Yeah, they have a clipboard. They take their notes. They're, you know, drawing pictures of animals that they don't have in their guide. They're looking for clues of animals. Like, you know, how do we know elephants are nearby? We can't see an elephant in the discovery room.
Right.
The room is a little bit too small to fit an elephant, but there is evidence around, and we get the kids thinking about what kind of evidence animals leave, what kind of clues you can look for, and things like that.
And the tree. Yeah, I love that tree. When I was in Africa, I said, there it is.
Yeah.
The real one is, it's just a little bigger.
Yeah.
I mean, you couldn't fit a, you know, a full-size one in. But it's really a, the tree culturally is important in Africa as part of the culture, and also, you know, in the ecology of the plains. It's an open ground.
Right. And we do try and bring some of that culture into how we discuss the tree and how people are using it as well.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So that's one of the... most impressive things when you walk in, you see this tree, right? And Ariane, what about some of the other things downstairs, that the other activities that we have?
Well, we have a cabinet of curiosities, and it's just this cabinet filled with these drawers, and the kids can open it up and look at different natural specimens. So there's different minerals, and there's shells, there's beetles in there, and it's just to give them an idea of where museums came from people's private collections. And they can make their own collection if they want and start thinking about if they were a curator at a museum, how they would display their collection. And they can have different themes. And we give them little cards and find five pretty minerals or something like that.
Right, like the old curiosity cabinets, I think,
in
the Victorian times,
cabinet.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Some of those wealthy folks had quite collections.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the museum has inherited some of that stuff. I know... one of the Rothschilds was a butterfly person, and I think he gave his collection to our museum. I don't know why he didn't give it to the British Museum, but maybe he didn't like those folks. And we got his whole butterfly collection, And another famous guy I know is Nabokov, the author. He worked at the museum as an amateur lepidopterist. And if you go when, well, I'm talking about the butterfly collection now, but it still has to do with the museum. And when you walk into the butterfly vivarium, which, by the way, folks, opens, what date does it open?
Saturday the 16th.
Saturday 16th. I'll talk more about the butterflies in the future. But anyhow, there's an exhibit of his butterfly collection as you walk into the butterflies. So a lot of our collections started that way, just the way you encourage kids to have a collection.
Yeah, and we encourage kids to bring their collections in if they want to know more about them as well.
Right.
Yeah.
I know the museum has an ID day to identify things, but you said that kids can bring things in any time that they come in?
Any time they come into the discovery room. We're not necessarily experts in IDing beetles or fossils, but we can always go to the resources, go to the books, and ask around. And there are a fair number of visitors who come on a regular basis who will bring the finds that they found in the parks or in their backyards and want to know more about them.
Good.
There was one kid who brought in his journal, and he wanted us to help him figure out the sex of his parakeets at home. And in his journal, he had taped feathers. So he had all these feathers, and then he had pigeon feather, and he wanted us to figure out the DNA. I mean, it was so cute. I tried to help him as best as I could.
He was on the right track. But
yeah. And I was like, I know I have to wait till a little bit older, but I don't want to wait. I want to know right now.
Terrific.
Yeah.
That's the kind of kid you love.
A budding scientist. Right? He's really passionate and interested in the natural world. It was great to see.
Right. And Barbara, do you wander around?
No.
You have a specialty.
I have a specialty. I have a specialty for children who are 8 years old and older. Sometimes kids come up to me and say, I've just made it to 8. Now I can come upstairs. And we have a lot of equipment up there that hands-on equipment that different kinds of scientists use. We have equipment that geologists use and biologists. And we have a seismograph and a spectroscope. And children can come up and have questions, and we can show them how those questions would be answered. How do we know what a star is made of? Well, sit them down in front of the spectroscope and explain how light separates and how we can tell what the light is made of, and they can get an idea of what an astronomer does.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, my favorite is the biology section, and sometimes kids don't know the questions to ask, but I always pose one question to them, and do we really know what's in the water in the pond in the park? And then we put it under a high resolution microscope and we look at the little microorganisms in there, and nothing turns kids on more than live things, and we have the smallest live things to show them in the museum, and it's very fun.
Right, and it's a terrific program. Those kids come upstairs, boy, and they don't want to leave.
I know, they're very excited.
Right.
Yeah.
And then we have our zookeeper upstairs, Ariana, because why don't you tell us some of the critters that you have upstairs? Some of them are quite unusual, and it's really like a zoo, right?
Yeah, so we mostly have insects and reptiles and amphibians. So one really popular animal we have is the Madagascar hissing cockroach.
Oh, right.
Yes, we have a whole tank full of them. And the idea there is to get kids and visitors to understand that not all insects are bad, and some insects play a very vital role in our ecosystem, and that these Madagascar hissing cockroaches are the garbage men of the natural world, and they break down all the dead leaf litter and stuff on the forest floor. And we let the kids hold the cockroach, and they just love that, and everyone wants to take a picture of them holding a cockroach and show how brave they are and gross out their family.
Well, how big are these cockroaches?
I don't know, like 3 to 4 inches, I guess.
Yes, so they're not they're much bigger than our domestic cockroaches, which are what, an inch?
They're smaller than
maybe that.
Depends on what part of the country you're from.
That's true. Yeah. Well, where are you from?
I'm from Atlanta.
Atlanta.
So our cockroaches got up to, 1.5 to 2 inches.
Oh, really? It's that good southern food. That's what it is, right? Chitlins and all that good stuff.
But most of the children that come up are from New York, and they're used to the New York cockroach, which is smaller and probably crawls through garbage and dumpsters and has a bad reputation. Very bad reputation.
Yeah.
So the initial response is usually eek, get it away from me. But then it's a teaching moment. It's a moment where we can explain to them how there are 3,500 different kinds of cockroaches in the world, and most of them live in the wild, and what they do and how they benefit us.
And they've been around a long time,
A long time.
In fact, you guys know that on the fourth floor, in the dinosaur hall, there's a mural on the wall right near the entrance to the dinosaur hall. And in the mural, it shows the flying dinosaurs, the pterodactyls, and on the they're on cliffs. And if you look on the cliff, there's a cockroach that was painted in to show that they've been around a long time, and they're really survivors.
I think so, 300 million years is an estimate that I've
There you
heard.
Go. See that? And I don't know if they've changed much over there. You know, they're so well designed that they survive almost anywhere, right? And mm-hmm. I wonder if they're used for food anywhere. Do you know that, Ariana, your research on edible insects?
I'm not sure.
Uh-huh.
Only on Fear Factor, as far as I know.
No. I've had people come in, mostly from Asia, and tell us that they have seen them barbecued and grilled and eaten by people in China and Vietnam and other places like that. So.
Yeah, well, you know, protein, if it's protein, people are going to eat it. If it's not poisonous, all over the world. When I was in Australia, I ate witchetty grubs, which are the grub or the larva of an insect, like in the caterpillar phase of its life. And they just put it on the fire and it gets crispy and you just crunch it down. And it doesn't taste like chicken, which, you know, everybody says things taste like chicken. I didn't have any special taste.
Tastes like grub.
Tastes like grub, right. And grub, I think it's very good with the Chinese dipping sauce. You put it in, you know, it's very nice. So anyway, it's good. Okay, so let's go back downstairs for a minute, because another favorite thing that I see the kids doing is that thing with the bones. Dan, you want to tell us about that dig that you have?
Kids love dinosaurs, and kids come to the museum specifically to see our dinosaur halls. And we'd be remiss to not include that on some level in the room. So we do have a dedicated paleontology section with two main activities. They can come in and they can actually excavate a fossil find, an oviraptor nest, a dinosaur sitting on a nest of eggs. And there's a lot that we can talk about how dinosaurs are connected to birds, but mostly kids want to experience digging, and they, you know, we make it as realistic as possible. They're actually uncovering sandstone. They're looking for bits of fossil and can take hours sitting at this space, digging up this fossil bed. And then they also have a prehistoric reptile, actually an animal that predates most of the dinosaurs, called Prestosuchus. And he's a 14-foot-long reptile. That's a giant puzzle. The pieces are magnetic or held on with pegs, and it's a challenge for them to put this animal together and start thinking about the symmetry of the animal, how its legs will be the same on each side, looking at the kinds of teeth it has, and asking questions about what they can learn from this animal and from putting it together. And also just the excitement of doing this paleontology. They put this animal together and they can go up onto the fourth floor and they can see the completed skeleton as well.
I notice also that you give them sort of a chisel to use, like a digging tool.
Yeah.
And they wear goggles, I noticed.
Chisels too. And goggles and brushes. And so brushes. They can That's feel great. Like the real paleontologists. We have some videos as well showing the actual excavation of the real fossil that ours is modeled after. So they can see the tools that the real paleontologists are using, see that you're using very similar tools, and really put them into that role.
Yeah, that's good too. First time I went in there, I went over there and sat down over there, and those kids wouldn't let me do a thing. They were having such a good time, but it was really great. So, and then we have other cultural things there besides natural history, right? I noticed you have something on people's hats, is it? You still have that hat?
Yeah, we have anthropology featured as well, and it's an area that allows us to change the exhibit on a regular basis. Most of the exhibits are large scale installations that are very expensive and difficult to switch out. But our anthropology exhibit features, you know, man-made items from around the world. We've featured hats from around the world. We've featured dolls and what you can learn from dolls and how people kind of express their culture through dolls. We've looked at household items from different cultures. We focus right now on items from the Silk Road, which was an exhibition that we put together in conjunction with the larger exhibition at the museum called Traveling the Silk Road.
Right.
So we do try to bring in cultures and give children a chance to experience cultural artifacts and learn how to look at an object and think about how that object would be placed into context or how they would use that object if they were approaching it from their own culture.
Right. Why the object looks the way it does and what is it used for.
Right.
That's good. Okay, so what we're going to do now is we're going to take a little short break, and when we come back, let's cover some of the other areas in the discovery room. Okay, so this is Bernie Wides with my guests today, Danny, Ariana, and Barbara, and we're going to take a break. Hi, this is Bernie Wides back on the air with the Naturalist Show today, and my guests again are Danny Ziegler.
Ziegler, yes.
I'll get it. All right. After I know you a few more years. And Ariana Ricard. And Barbara Cohen is easy. Barbara Cohen. Okay, who Danny is the person who keeps, who's in charge of the Discovery Room, all the responsibilities of getting supplies and keeping it going and keeping everything from breaking and all that stuff. And Ariana is
science coordinator.
Science coordinator. Oh, that's your official title. Mm-hmm. That's good. Okay. And Barbara Cohen is a volunteer there, right, Barbara?
Yeah, yeah.
And Barbara loves to work with microscopes. I know that. Because when I first met her and I told her what I was doing, she said, wow, right?
Yeah.
Didn't you have a worm project you were working on for years?
I had a worm project.
Just tell us very briefly about that worm project.
Well, some of the scientists in the museum at the Center for Biodiversity collected gallons and gallons and gallons of material from the reef, a reef down in the Bahamas, and brought it back, and they needed somebody dumb like me to go through every single inch of it and see what was alive or what had been alive in that sample as a baseline study for organisms that lived in and around the reef in case there was an oil spill or global mm-hmm. warming. They could go back and see what has changed.
Were these terrestrial worms or
marine
worms?
No, they're marine worms. Most of them lived in tubes or other kinds
of... Okay, tube worms, polychaete worms, annelid worms?
Polychaete worms, many, many different kinds. After the first year, we submitted some of the samples to a scientist who was involved in the project. I'm sorry, I don't know what his name was. And he told us that about 20% of the worms that we found were absolutely new to science.
Yeah. That happens all the time.
Yeah. So if they ever, it took me 5 years to go through the samples with students that came in the summer and other volunteers. It will take them 10 years probably to categorize all the worms that we found, and then they'll make some sort of paper
on it. So you see, folks, there's all kinds of ways to learn and all kinds of experiences, if you're open to it. And in the natural world, I think there's still thousands of critters that haven't been identified, you know, from plankton all the way up to probably, maybe not mammals, but other critters. Dan?
There was just a report last week about a new species of bat found in Papua New Guinea.
Right.
In a survey that was done there last year. But yeah. I'm certain that, you know, in the samples that we take of the turtle pond from Central Park, there are species in there that have never been categorized or identified. And I mean, we aren't the experts in the discovery room. It's our job to look at these things and get excited about looking at them. But it would be nice at some point to try and figure out, do a diversity study of the turtle pond and see what's there and what hasn't been discovered yet.
You know, remember they did a bioblitz of Central Park?
Mm-hmm.
You remember that?
It was 6 years ago, I think. Yeah.
Did they take water samples for the bioblitz at all?
I don't think they did water samples. I think it was just leaf litter and live capture, yeah.
Sure, that would be a great project to do.
Maybe for that one, they discovered a new species of centipede that it was living in Central Park.
Yeah. And if you discover a new species, you could name it after yourself, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's true. If you look some of the Latin scientific names, you know, I have a friend who was a scientist years ago at the museum, and he discovered a new plankton. And the last name of the plankton is Friedenthali, because his name is Friedenthal. And that's the way you do it. So you want to be famous, Barbara? Go back, get those worms.
I think we should initiate this immediately.
Okay, so that's perfect for the discovery room, discovering things and, you know, opening up your mind to other stuff.
One of the great things about discovering was, in addition to educating the visitors, our volunteers are learning so much about so many different topics. And I was talking to one of our volunteers yesterday, and she was saying that volunteering at the museum has really changed her life and opened her eyes to new experiences, and she wanted to go to new places. And mm-hmm. even with we have the set pieces in the discovery room, like Danny said, but we also change things for the special exhibits, and then there's a new exhibit, and the volunteers have to learn all about that topic, and some do their own research and read books and watch films, and it's really a wonderful place. And our volunteers are fabulous. I mean, I think that's one of the greatest assets of the discovery room. We have 70-plus volunteers, like Barbara Cohen, who are so into science and so enthusiastic and can share that with the public, and I think that's one of the reasons why people keep coming back. I'm sure Barbara has fans that come every Tuesday because she's there Tuesdays so they can work with her.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm a volunteer at the museum also, and that's how I got into a lot of the science stuff and everything. And I think the museum has 1,200 volunteers working in all areas of the museum. So it's really a big asset for the museum. Mm-hmm. And as you said, we get an education at the same time. So folks out there, if any of you live within this sensible commuting distance of the museum, you can volunteer at the museum. You just come down, ask for the volunteer office, tell them what you're interested in, and usually they can find something for you to do. And the people who are in the discovery room are really dedicated folks. They really, and they work hard. How many hours do you put in there on a shift, Barbara?
4 hours. 4 hours. Each Tuesday.
Yeah, 4 hours each day. So if you have some spare time, even people who are working, they volunteer on the weekends. Mm-hmm. So it's a great program. So let's get back specifically to the discovery room. There's some areas we haven't really touched at all. Even downstairs, I know. Do you still have that thing where the kids can record their story?
We've
removed.
Do you
still have that, Dan? I remember that.
That one. The discovery room's been open for nearly 10 years now, yeah. And that exhibit a couple of years ago, the equipment failed on us.
Okay.
But we did find that it became more of a distraction than anything else. Children were spending their time playing games and singing songs to their friends instead of talking about the things that they were learning in the room, and it just became a little noisy. And
yeah,
so we've removed that one and replaced it with a live animal exhibit, a rotting log habitat, which is one of favorite
yeah.
pieces.
That's downstairs now in the back,
yeah.
Where the video cameras were.
Yes, that's down where the video cameras were. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That's great. You can have a whole world in a rotting log.
Exactly. Yeah. And we have a habitat that's been active for over 7 years, a frog and lots of pill bugs and a whole community that is almost self-sustaining. We add water and we'll drop in a couple of bits of apple every now and then, but for the most part, we have this great community of organisms. And you know, kids who come in from New York City who haven't spent much time outside or haven't really—I mean, this is not something that is very. It baffles me that kids haven't had this experience, but they come in, they've never turned over a log in the park.
Right.
And so we give them the chance to do that in the discovery room, just flipping over a log and seeing a whole community of organisms underneath the log, eating away at the wood, recycling nutrients. It's a great miniature lesson, something I recommend that can...
It's a whole miniature little ecosystem you have there.
It's something that teachers can do in a classroom, something that I love to talk about for anybody who wants to bring some outdoors inside.
And there's no shortage of rotting logs, even in New York City.
No, especially after the weather we've been having
this
last
year.
That's
right, all those trees that were knocked down and all that stuff. Right.
Yeah.
Okay, Arianna, how about any problems? You know, you have these whole variety of animals up there. What about feeding them? Now, I know you told me about the silkworms. You had to get special food for the silkworms. What about all those other animals that you have in there?
The other ones are pretty easy, but we do experiment, like trying different fruit that they'll like. I'm going to try yams. That's a new thing. But otherwise, it's fairly easy. You just have to go to the pet store or go to the grocery store to get the food that they need.
Do you go to Fairway Market?
Why, of course I do.
That's one of our sponsors. That's why I said that, right?
Doesn't everybody?
Sure. Yeah, right. So
they only eat Fairway. The animals are very particular.
That's good, yes. What about, I know you have some new critters in there, those little mud skippers, are they called?
Yeah, we just got a mud skipper
couple
weeks
ago. Tell us
ago.
About those. Those are really cute, interesting little animals.
Yeah, they're fish that actually walk on land. So their pectoral fins are modified so that they can use them for walking. So that's kind of interesting to see that. He's kind of shy right now, so he's been hiding. But also they have modified like air pockets. So then when they come out of the water, they fill the air pockets with air and with water, and they keep the gills moist, and they breathe through their skin, their moist skin, too. So they have these different modifications for living, getting out of the water for a little bit.
Also, their eyes, I think, are interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I think they can focus out of the water and underwater. I read something about their eyes.
That's probably true. I don't know.
You know, if you can picture a mud skipper, is that it? Or a mud puppy?
Mud skipper.
Mud skipper. They're these cute little critters, and they have great big eyes, and they sit in the water with just their eyes sticking up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And their eyes are pretty big compared to the size of their head. And I think they do have vision for underwater and in air also. I'll have to check on that, but I read that somewhere. And so they're really interesting little critters.
Yeah.
And the other ones, you have the cockroaches, you have the mud skippers, you have some fish.
some guppies and some lover grasshoppers. We've got a green frog, bullfrogs, a tree frog, a bearded dragon, a
gecko,
the leopard gecko, Vietnamese walking stick insects, African.
Oh, you have walking stick insects too.
Yeah, we've got baby Vietnamese walking stick insects right now.
Okay, tell people about walking sticks. I mean, the only one that most people know is like the praying mantis.
So well, we try to have animals in the room that can teach us specific concepts. So with the walking stick insects, they're perfect for talking about camouflage. And the kids will ask them, well, why do you think it looks like a stick? And you can show them how they sort of sway in the breeze if you spray them with water. And that's another animal where you can see how it is an insect. The kids can count the legs. And so it's a nice animal to have.
And there are two animals where the opposite of camouflage applies. We have a lubber grasshopper, which is quite red in color.
And how big are they, Barbara?
They're about the biggest grasshoppers you'll ever see. They're probably, the females are much bigger than the males, and they can get up to about 2.5 inches long, I think. And they're huge. And the kids can hold them. And when they flap their wings, the inside of their wings, the wings are too small to carry them in flight.
Mm.
They don't use them for flight, but they do use them for communications and warning. And when they flap them, they're bright red inside, which raises the question, after you've talked about camouflage with some of the other animals, you can ask the children what they think the red color means. And quite a few of them know, probably from our frog exhibit, that bright colors in animals quite often means that they're poisonous. And sometimes the kids will come up with that answer. Sometimes we'll talk about it, about how this is a warning mechanism for prey that might want a nice grasshopper for lunch and stays away because of the color.
Yeah, where are they from? Do you know, Danny?
They're southeastern United States. Also, so they're most common in Florida on roadsides, citrus plantations. I've read they go as far north as North Carolina, but I never saw them growing up in Georgia, so I don't.
Okay.
I'm sure I believe it
because
it's published in scientific papers, but I wish I'd seen them growing up. It would have been a lot of fun.
A lot of fun to see them, yeah. Yeah, they seem like they'd be great things for kids to grab and put in a jar and take home and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, they're very docile. They don't hop. They don't fly. So they're very easy to handle. It's always exciting to have a child holding one in their hand and start talking about them and get them to realize what the color is. And once they realize that they're holding something that's poisonous, they get this kind of moment of fear. And then that, you know, is another teachable moment. We can talk about the difference between something that's poisonous or venomous. And
sure.
Just because it's poisonous doesn't mean it's going to bite you or sting you. Just don't eat it.
Right, just don't eat it. Like with the butterflies.
Yeah.
We tell people, butterflies are poisonous. And they, whoa. But it's the same thing. If you eat it, maybe you'll get sick. But, you know, it'll make a bird sick. But I don't know about a human, depends on it. But there are a lot of other little poisonous critters that we'll talk about in another show when we talk about phytoplankton, which will be next week. Maybe we will have a phytoplankton show on, or maybe the week after. I don't know yet the schedule, but we'll see. But also, now, have you changed the philosophy at all? Have you been limited to what the original setup was? And I know Jay had a little different approach when he was in charge. I think
the room was kind of initiated. The design of the room was initiated by a woman named Ann Pruitt, who had been at the museum for several years, doing discovery room type programming on a limited basis. And I worked for Ann for the first 4 years that I was there, and I've stuck to the kind of philosophies that she presented initially. This kind of place for exploration, placed for kids to come in and get some exposure to the natural world that they wouldn't necessarily get elsewhere in the city. You know, I spent a lot of time outside as a child in Georgia, and so I've brought in a lot more of the live animal exhibits, and really want to give children a chance to just sit and observe and see some of what the natural world has to offer in order to build that excitement.
Right, I think we need more of that.
Yeah.
I mean, kids, city kids especially, you know, with the video games and all that other stuff, they get glued to it. But, you know, there's nothing like the natural world, in my opinion, anyhow. So, what about, do you have any unusual experiences with parents in the room or with kids.
Yeah, just yesterday, actually, because the museum visitors is 40% international. So that's also just fun to get these people from all over the world and hear about their experiences and see them working together. We have this bingo box game. So it's
what
identification
like?
Bingo. Yeah. So there are different natural specimens, and the kids get bingo cards. And on the bingo cards, there's an I for insect, R for reptile, M for mammal, and B for bird. So they take, there's about 40 natural specimens. So they pull out the natural specimen and they have to decide if it belongs to a mammal, a reptile, an insect, or a bird. So it's a classification game. And then if they get it right, then everyone gets to put a, you know, B for bird on it. So we had one family that was Asian and then two other families were Middle Eastern, and they were all playing bingo together. And it was just so wonderful to see these families working together and the parents so engaged with their children's education and them learning all together. And there was one moment where I had given the answer sheets to all the parents so they could all play along, and the Asian mother made a mistake and told her daughter the answer, and they talked to each other in Chinese, and then she translated, but she's like, oh, she just told me the answer. We're like, oh, we understood what happened, you don't need to explain it to us because everybody knew. But it was really great to see that.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we do have an international clientele, and sometimes it causes problems with different cultural references. So, like, you have to be careful sometimes what you say. I found that as an explainer in the halls, you know. I'll give you a cultural thing that's happening today. So if you have a little kid and he's there with an older man, okay, a man who maybe is 50 or something like that, you used to be able to say to him, who brought you to, did your grandfather bring you to the museum today? But you can't say that anymore because the older man may be his father because of people getting married later. So now what I say to them, I said, let's see, his name is John. I say, John, who did you bring to the museum today with you? Because, you know, if you call the guy his grandfather and he's not the grandfather, I mean, it's very, you know, it's not nice. So I found that out. But your contact with adults, do you ever had the occasion where, let's say you want a kid to hold a cockroach, and the mother says, no, don't touch that.
Oh, that's a very frequent occurrence. And you know, the only way that I found to really counteract that is just to remain completely calm, not react at all to the parent's own aversion, and just show that this is not something that you have any reason to fear. We do train a lot of teachers in the room as well on how to do this kind of work with their classrooms, and that's one of the main lessons I'll give them. If you have live things in your classroom, if you have anything that you want to bring out for them, you have to make sure that you don't present any fear, because that fear gets translated to them. They'll pick that up, and that's not a lesson that we want to teach. The main cultural experience that I've had in the room where a foreign visitor was upset with something that we had in the room. So we had our hats exhibit, and we had a hat of four winds, which is a kind of a Scandinavian cultural hat, which has four points on the top. And there's this little girl who comes every year. She's Finnish, and her father is American, and so they bring her to New York once a year, and she always comes to the Discovery Room for a couple of times during that New York visit. And she came when we had our hats exhibit and looked at this hat, which we had labeled from Norway, and she said, no, this is a Finnish hat. And she wrote us a new label. She gave us the copy.
Terrific. Yeah. That's good. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can learn from the kids too, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's great. So is there anything else you want to add about the Discovery Room at all? Anything? Because we have a minute left of this show, and then we'll wrap it up. Barbara,
go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, I'm having a great time volunteering there, and I urge anybody who wants to learn more, even though you're way over the age of going to school and want to keep your mind busy, go to the museum and volunteer.
Good. Okay. Ariana, what were you going to say?
Oh, I was just going to talk about our special programs. We have a Gateway Storytime program, and that's Monday mornings.
What is that?
That's for kids 2.5 to about 4, and it's a different theme each week. So it's a 45-minute program. So the first 15 minutes is they get free play, and the next 15 minutes we read a story and sing a song. Like, we're going to do spiders for Halloween. Mm-hmm. And the last 15 minutes we go out to some part of the museum that connects to what we're talking about that day. So it's a nice way for younger kids to feel more comfortable at the museum, feel like it's less intimidating, and then they get introduced to these different topics. It's a fun way for them to learn. It's a very popular program.
Sounds good. Okay, and we should emphasize that the discovery room is included with the admission to the museum, right?
It's included with admission to the museum, but hours are limited.
Okay.
So check our website, amnh.org, search for the discovery room. You'll find our hours listed there. We also are limited in size. We're limited to how many people we can take at a time. We only allow 50 people in the room at any given time. So if you are interested in coming to the discovery room, stop by the room as soon as you get to the museum, and that will give you a chance to either come in at that point or reserve a space for a later time.
Right, and there's always a line to get in, so that's good advice, Danny. I see people waiting online, and they can't wait to get in there, so do you give out those cards as
a reservation? Yeah, we'll give out passes. We do 40-minute timed sessions.
Oh, that's good.
And so we give out passes to reserve space for those times.
Terrific. So we're going to just wrap this up now. This program, as you've been hearing, is about the Discovery Room at the Museum of Natural History. And we have three of the key people here from the Discovery Room. Danny, who is the man in charge of the whole operation, a lot of responsibility. And he's ably assisted these last couple of years by Adriana. Right, Ariana?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And Barbara's, how long have you been there, Barbara, in the Discovery Room? A couple of years?
A couple of years.
You started around the same time I did, so at least 5 years now, yeah.
Is that 5 years?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's hard to remember.
So Barbara is a terrific volunteer there, and you too can be a volunteer at the Discovery Room or anything at the museum. And as we say, it's included with the admission to the museum,
right.
So you don't have to pay anything extra. And if you have a grandson, a grandchild, babies yourselves, nieces, nephews, anybody, or even if you're an adult and you'd like to see it, Dan, they could come in and take a look around,
As long as we've got space.
As long as there's space, right. So I want to thank my guests today, and we're going to be signing off in a minute. And that concludes our program for today on the Discovery Room, and it really is a place of discovery, and it's very nice asset to the museum. And also I noticed you have some clothing from Antarctica there because of the Antarctic exhibit, right?
Right.
I noticed that last week upstairs. So you do reach out to the current exhibits and have stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah, too. Right.
Anytime there's a new thing at the museum, we try to complement it.
Okay, so this is Bernie Wides, a naturalist, signing off today with my very nice guest. The program is The Naturalist, and we'll see you next time.